From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last week, three human rights workers were murdered in West Timor. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Mary Robinson, the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, about the difficulties of protecting humanitarian workers in increasingly dangerous situations. Robinson is also the former president of Ireland. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews recordings by two countertenors, the German singer Andrea Scholl and American David Daniels. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie Almost Famous about a teenaged reporter for Rolling Stone. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mary Robinson has been exposed to man's worst inhumanities to man. She is the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and has traveled to countries around the world to gather information about human rights violations. Last week, she was in New York for the UN's Millennial Meeting of World Leaders. Before becoming a UN High Commissioner in 1997, she spent 7 years as the President of Ireland, 20 years as a member of the Irish Senate. In Ireland, her priorities included overturning laws that prohibited divorce, homosexuality, and the dissemination of birth control. Among the issues she's dealing with now is last week's murder of three UN workers in West Timor. They were assisting refugees who had fled the militias in East Timor. The UN workers were attacked and killed by militia members who had just attended the funeral of one of their leaders. I spoke with Mary Robinson yesterday. She was in Geneva, where her UN office is located. I want to read an email that was printed in the New York Times that was sent by one of the UN workers who was killed. And he sent this shortly before the rampage. He wrote, "We sent most of the staff home, rushing to safety. I just heard someone on the radio saying that they are praying for us in the office. The militias are on the way, and I am sure they will do their best to demolish this office. These guys act without thinking and can kill a human as easily and painlessly as I kill mosquitoes in my room. You should see this office, plywood on the windows, staff peering out through openings in the curtains hastily installed a few months ago. We are waiting for this enemy. We sit here like bait, unarmed, waiting for a wave to hit." What is your reaction when you hear something like this, and when you hear about UN workers who are murdered?
I must say I received a copy of that email just when I heard of the killings, and it still disturbs me terribly to think of the person who was writing that and actually planning for the next day, like a good human rights humanitarian worker. And we have to remember, there's a lot of discussion at the moment about UN peacekeeping missions, but the humanitarian workers work beyond where the peacekeepers go. There are no UN peacekeepers in West Timor. It was unarmed men and women working for humanitarian purposes, bringing food and shelter and water and healthcare to desperate refugees. Now we have hundreds of thousands, certainly 100,000 refugees in West Timor who suffer, who potentially will starve, who potentially will die or become seriously ill over the coming days because they will not be given that kind of care and attention. It's also something that has happened in Sierra Leone, something that has happened elsewhere. And it's happening too often to humanitarian staff, be they UN or be they working for non-governmental organisations. And I think it's really important that the world take note and that we respect the integrity and the safety and security of humanitarian staff, of all who work on behalf of humanity, basically.
UN workers and other human rights workers were evacuated from West Timor after these murders. Does this give you more reservations about sending UN workers to places where they are in grave danger?
You know, the concern of humanitarian and human rights workers is to get to those who desperately need help and support. Yes, there has to be attention to security, and those of us who head programs such as Madame Ogata heading refugees and my own job as High Commissioner for Human Rights, we have a real responsibility to our staff, to colleagues, and it hurts like losing a family member when somebody is killed like that or seriously wounded in action. It's terribly hard for families who, you know, have seen their son or daughter go off, and they're very proud of them, that they're going to work to help the most vulnerable sectors. And then they hear not only that they've been killed, but the appalling circumstances of some of the deaths. I was in East Timor a few weeks ago, and I undertook, and indeed I'm following through on this, to send a personal envoy following my visit to address the whole situation of the refugees in West Timor, how to ensure that they can return and begin a new life in the building up of the society in East Timor, security in East Timor itself, justice, accountability for past atrocities. So it's an urgent problem that needs more political support.
But, you know, that's the thing. Who do you hold accountable? Like, these murders were done by men involved with militias. Militias aren't really accountable.
I think that there must be a very serious responsibility of the Indonesian authorities. I did, in fact, take the opportunity during the Millennium Summit to raise this with President Wahid himself briefly when I met him at one of the meetings of the Millennium Council, as did others. He said that they were sending additional troops. That is certainly necessary. There's a need for greater security of the population there, but there's also a need for accountability and for justice, for bringing to justice those who are responsible for these recent atrocities, but also those who were responsible this time last year. There was the referendum on the 30th of August. Before that, and in particular in the weeks following, there was appalling killing and driving people from their homes, driving them up to the hills, capturing women. I was in a church recently in Suai, in East Timor, where on the 6th of September last year, 200 people were massacred in the church. Young girls were raped in the church itself. And some of the widows still don't have the bodies of their husbands or their sons, their family members to bury. So there is a very serious accounting that has to be done by the authorities of Indonesia. I'm aware that the Attorney General of Indonesia, whom I know personally, is trying, but much, much more needs to be done, and it needs more political, you know, authority of the Security Council, which did focus on this during last week, during the special session of the Millennium Summit.
My guest is Mary Robinson. She's joining us from Geneva. She's the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She's held that position since 1997. Before that, she spent 7 years as President of Ireland. UN human rights workers don't carry guns, but their enemies often do. Do you think that there are new protections that are needed for human rights workers?
Yes, I think there needs to be a commitment to secure the safety of human rights and humanitarian workers. Also, we need to look more closely at the spread of arms and both legal and illegal trade in small arms. I hope that some of the initiatives in curtailing the sale of small arms and indeed arms generally will receive much more attention from the Security Council, from the rich countries that make so much money selling guns, ammunition, firepower, helicopters, all that terrible destructive arsenal to those who then will use this on human rights and humanitarian aid workers at times in their countries. Look at the arms build-up by both Ethiopia and Eritrea at a time when their populations are starving. Look at the way in which there are sales of arms by the United States, by the United Kingdom, by France, by so many of the developed countries to various developing countries who should not be committing so much of their resources to buying arms at this stage. And it's interesting that we are seeing important steps being taken in trying to prevent conflicts. For example, if you look at Sierra Leone and if you look at Liberia, but at the heart of the continuing conflict there is diamonds, greed and fighting about diamonds. And for the first time recently, we had the Security Council ready to focus on the illegal diamond trade. Well, now let's focus on the trade in small arms and the trade in arms generally to countries where there is conflict. And let's stop seeing huge profits being made that ultimately result in lives being put at risk, and in that context, lives of those who work for the United Nations being put at risk.
I know one of the issues that you're very concerned about is the growing number of children who are being deployed as soldiers. I know you're worried about the human rights of the children. Are you also worried that children with guns are much more unpredictable and irresponsible and perhaps even more likely to threaten the lives of human rights workers?
Yes, and I must say I'm very glad that the whole subject of child soldiers has become such a primary topic now on the international agenda. I met some child soldiers in Freetown in Sierra Leone when I was there in June of last year. I sat in a shelter for homeless children in Freetown, which is actually run by an Irish aid agency called GOAL, and I listened to them. And the first thing they told me was that most of them had been forced to become soldiers. They hadn't sort of gone with a sense of it would be great fun to have a gun. It wasn't even that. They were compelled. They were drugged. Some of them were physically, some of them were sexually abused, and they were just pushed into the front line. And it's not just boys, boys and girls. And they killed, and then they maimed and, you know, chopped off arms and legs of other children. They were then availing of this shelter. They escaped and came to this shelter. And most of them, the real thing they wanted to do was to find their parents. They were in Freetown. Their parents were somewhere else in Sierra Leone. I mean, what a childhood. What a denial of everything that childhood means. And the reality is it's extremely important that all that emphasis on legal instruments is carried through.
My guest is Mary Robinson, the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights. She's the former president of Ireland. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Mary Robinson is my guest. She's the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She's held that position since 1997. Before that, she spent 7 years as President of Ireland. What do you think were the most important outcomes of last week's Millennial Assembly at the United Nations?
I think it was a very realistic and almost somber meeting. I was afraid that it might be a bit like some meetings in the past where people came with fine words and pontificated and then left. But it wasn't really like that. Even the whole way in which it was organized, you had presidents and prime ministers sitting around in a circle actually discussing issues. You had a very serious and somber meeting of the Security Council, which began with a minute's silence for the three UNHCR refugees workers who had been killed in West Timor. You had a declaration of the summit which has a lot of practical issues. In fact, my office is studying it at the moment because we can see ways in which there will be follow-up to the Millennium Declaration. It discussed a very important recent report on peacekeeping. It's called the Brahimi Report because the person who headed a senior panel of experts was a former Algerian ambassador, and he has a very good understanding of what's wrong about the UN peacekeeping at the moment. What are the weaknesses? Why were soldiers captured in Sierra Leone? Why is the UN constantly on the defensive and not able to do its job? And this report, both politically and technically, spells out what's wrong and makes it very clear what needs to be done. And during the Millennium Summit, the leaders of the world were addressing that report. And, you know, I think people have just run out of patience with fine words. We're going to measure the progress on this Millennium Declaration, which has a lot of practical issues in it.
As a woman, do you see certain issues confronting women that have not quite been defined as human rights issues in the past that you want to define as human rights issues now?
I think it's very helpful to women in particular that that we have this broad agenda of human rights, and therefore that it includes economic and social rights, and recognises that poverty is a terrible deprivation of human rights. Because, of course, if you look at issues of poverty, you have the feminization of poverty. It is predominantly women who are the poorest and the most vulnerable in situations of poverty, in situations of indigenous peoples. And to have that broader agenda makes that whole human rights agenda more relevant to women. But also there are special issues of concern to women, which are issues surrounding female, you know, women's sexuality, reproductive rights, the way in which women legislatively and in other ways do not have an equal situation in many countries, and that this has to be addressed. I sometimes have said to me, well, you know, we have a different culture. And I say, no, I don't accept that you can have a culture to justify violations of human rights or denial of human rights.
Give me an example of what you're talking about there.
I'm talking about, for example, female genital mutilation, that young girls are genitally mutilated because it is, in quotes, the culture. And I say, no, it is a traditional practice that damages women, damages young girls, damages their health, damages their whole psyche, I believe. It cannot be tackled abruptly from the outside. It must be tackled by education from within. And it's very notable. There was a very good Egyptian study which showed that women at girls who had access to secondary education, much fewer of them were subjected to female genital mutilation. When they went to third level, none of them would dream of accepting this practice, and they would have the courage and the independence and the capacity to say, no, that's not for me. It's those who are trapped in situations of poverty, it's women who have had no opportunity to have a choice in the matter, who feel conditioned by the so-called customs and traditional practices. So we have to address this through education. Similarly, in certain countries, women are not entitled to vote. In some countries, they're not entitled to drive cars and participate in economic activity. We have a long way to go. And in particular, we have a long way to go in ensuring that women have choice in relation to the number and spacing of their children.
Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the UN, wants the UN to more regularly intervene in civil wars. Do you think that the UN should be taking a greater role in civil wars around the world, or do you think it should be, you know, more concerned with wars between different countries? And is it equipped to take a more active role in civil wars, even if it, you know, even if it feels it should be the mission?
I think it's a great tribute to Kofi Annan that he has the vision to decide that it's time at the beginning of this century that we put human security and the human person at the centre of all our work. When the United Nations was established, there was great emphasis on the sovereignty of nations. And if you look at the United Nations Charter, it pays great attention to state sovereignty. And that has been important. But when there are serious violations of human rights taking place, what Kofi Annan is urging the members of the United Nations to think about and to address is how can we say that human rights or protection of human rights stops at the border, and that a sovereign country is entitled to grossly violate the rights and the security and the lives, perhaps, of large numbers of its citizens. That's just not acceptable anymore. And I think this is a great advance. Now, it needn't always be military intervention. There are political possibilities. There's the possibility of using economic sanctions. There's a possibility of public opinion. There's a possibility of all kinds of ways of addressing it. And then, ultimately, the Secretary General has asked the members of the United Nations to think very carefully of situations where the United Nations can and should legally intervene, where it is necessary to protect human security, where there is a very real threat of serious human rights violations that threaten the lives and security of large numbers of people.
We were talking before about how vulnerable human rights workers and UN workers are when they're working in other countries. What about you when you're traveling and visiting countries in which there are flagrant human rights violations? How are you protected during those travels?
Well, sometimes I'm in situations where I would perhaps wish for a bit more protection. But generally, what I find is there is quite an emotional toll, because I listen to so many tragic stories of human rights violations, whether it's in Chechnya, where I was last March, or Sierra Leone in June of last year, or as I said, more recently in East Timor, where I sat with this group of women, and they told me of the terrible stories. And one woman handed up to me a little, a beautiful little girl, and she was born from a rape at that church in Suai. I asked what her name was, and as it happened, her name was Mary. And it was so important to reinforce that this child must not be discriminated against, because she happens to be the child of a horrific rape. And so I was encouraging this woman to... And, you know, I do find that after a visit to a place of great conflict where I have listened to such terrible first-hand accounts of man's inhumanity to man, that takes its toll. So, but there have been times. There was a time in Colombia and Bogota where I had gone to a meeting of human rights defenders to open a seminar on human rights defenders, and I had left that meeting and we were told that they were being threatened with a bomb attack. And in fact, I went back to the meeting because I had some security with me, and I felt that by going back I would help their overall security situation. But I was aware that there were risks involved. I think because of my rank and status, I'm more protected than many others. Those I admire are those who remain in situations of conflict. And I do think that it is extremely sad and unacceptable that very brave humanitarian workers pay for it with their lives. And I have met parents of those who have died doing humanitarian and human rights work. And it's a very painful thing to hear the pride of the parents, but that terrible sense of loss.
Mary Robinson is the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights. She's the former president of Ireland. Our interview was recorded yesterday morning. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Saab, featuring an all-turbocharged lineup, with safety features like the Saab Active Head Restraint System, SaabUSA.com, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, serving as President of Ireland, we continue our talk with Mary Robinson, now the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reviews recordings by countertenors Andrea Scholl and David Daniels. And Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie Almost Famous about a teenaged reporter at Rolling Stone in the 70s. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mary Robinson. Since 1997, she's been the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. For 7 years before that, she served as President of Ireland. She spent 20 years in the Irish Senate and also worked as a human rights lawyer. Did coming from Ireland help you understand civil war?
I think it did. It helped me to understand, in particular, the concerns of developing countries. Because Ireland, after all, during the last century, had a terrible famine, a terrible potato famine over 3 years between 1845 and 1847. It had a huge dispersal of people who emigrated to so many countries, in particular the United States and Canada. It had the problem of struggling for its independence. It was for a very long time a colony. It had the problem then of building up its economy and its sense of statehood as a new state this century. That's the experience of many developing countries. And I think it has given me insights and it has given me room to maneuver, if I could put it that way, that I'm not just seen as a representative of a developed Western country. I'm seen as a former president of Ireland, which, after all, has shared the experience that a lot of developing countries have now.
You spent 20 years in the Irish Senate, and in that capacity, you were a leader in trying to overturn laws against homosexuality, birth control, and divorce. Why were those priorities for you?
I think I was conscious, growing up in an Ireland which was predominantly Catholic, but where the laws of the country over-reflected the influence of the Catholic religion, that it was important for a modern Ireland that was to have good relations with Northern Ireland, where the majority were Protestant, that was to create a state which would indeed fully respect the human rights and civil liberties which are proclaimed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that there was a need for change. I did introduce a number of proposals in the Irish Senate, the upper house of the Irish Parliament, but I found that perhaps a more successful way of making progress was to take cases to the Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. I had several cases, as you said, on the law criminalising all homosexual acts, on the legislation in Ireland which discriminated against children born out of wedlock, out of marriage, and these provided an opportunity to create more space for individual freedoms, to reduce the role of the state, as I think it was very appropriate to do. And that was the kind of human rights background that perhaps prepared me for the different job that I'm doing now, which is still centering on human rights.
Now, you personally oppose abortion, but you tried to make it possible for women to get access to information about abortion and access to abortion. Why did you support that if you personally oppose it?
I came from a very fortunate background. I was the only girl among four brothers, treasured. Any of my close relatives had that same approach, etc. So I wasn't living the experience of many women where they were in danger of having, and especially in an Irish context, an unwanted pregnancy which would threaten their health, which would create very serious both physical and mental difficulties for them. And I was aware that the limits on access to information about family planning were actually augmenting the number of unwanted pregnancies and putting pressure on women to have abortions. So for the 20 years that I was in the Irish Senate, I was trying to bring down the Irish abortion rate by widening the choice by legalising family planning. Eventually, access to contraceptives was legalised. But I was also aware that in reality, hundreds and indeed ultimately several thousand Irish women were going to various clinics in Britain mainly for abortions because they had made that choice themselves. Again, I worry about whether they had adequate counselling to open up options for them, but they were taking the boat and taking the plane, some of them very poor, borrowing money, giving false names, being at risk of being exploited, being at risk of not having proper medical care. And these are real concerns. They remain real concerns in the Irish context. So that I think it's a problem that needs to be addressed from the point of view of obviously of the issues involved, of the importance of the right to life, the importance of the right to life of the unborn, but also the importance of the health and choice and counselling and a range of options open to women, some of whom can be in extremely difficult circumstances.
So now contraception is more available and legal in Ireland?
Yes, there was a. I made three attempts in the Irish Senate, and then eventually the government passed what at the time was a very inadequate family planning bill. But now the legislation is much better, and indeed there is much more promotion of family planning, and indeed there is active discussion of more education about sexuality and relationships in schools, and many schools are now giving good leadership in this area, and that is a very welcome change. And of course Irish people are travelling abroad, and Irish people who've done very well abroad are coming back to make their lives in Ireland, bring up their children in what is a very good educational system. So it's there have been a lot of very positive changes.
Abortion is still illegal.
Abortion is still illegal, but under the Constitution, there is an issue at present before the Irish Parliament as to whether in certain circumstances where there is a risk to the life of the mother, abortion would be legal under Irish law. It's a complex issue. I'm out of Ireland at the moment and obviously don't want to broach it very directly, but it is a matter that is being actively discussed, and there has recently been a government paper on the matter, and it is, in a sense, pending before the Irish Parliament.
And divorce?
Divorce has been legalised.
And homosexuality?
The Irish government accepted the ruling of the court in Strasbourg that it was contrary to the European Convention to criminalise all acts of homosexuality, and there was Irish legislation providing that it would not be criminal for consenting adults.
My guest is Mary Robinson, the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights. She's the former president of Ireland. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Mary Robinson is my guest. She's the former president of Ireland, the current UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She's speaking to us from Geneva. You know, you are so involved now in human rights issues in civil wars around the world. It's probably unfair of me to relate this, but let me just ask you. You are Catholic and married a man who is Protestant. When you married him, your parents were so upset that you were marrying outside of your faith and marrying a Protestant that they wouldn't come to your wedding. That must have said something to you about how deep feelings are in ethnic and religious feuds and differences.
Yes, in a way, it certainly has helped to, I think, give me insights, and indeed my husband and our children insights, by the fact that we are an inter-church marriage, or as they call it in Ireland, a mixed marriage. There were complex reasons why none of my family were at the wedding. I was, as I said, the only daughter. I think they had huge expectations and hopes, and they didn't think that I had made the right choice. I'm glad to say I knew I had. We're coming up to our 30th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
I must say I've been very fortunate indeed. But I would say that in particular, it helped me to understand some of the issues that were beginning to surface in relation to Northern Ireland. And in 1985, when the first Anglo-Irish agreement was agreed between the British and Irish governments, I was one of the few voices that said, this agreement will not bring about the peace that we want in Northern Ireland because it hasn't been fully discussed and there hasn't been adequate consultation with Northern Protestants. Now, I was, I think, more able to have insights into that because of the fact that I was married to a Protestant, that he had relations in Northern Ireland, that I had very broad contacts in Northern Ireland. I resigned to the backbenches of the Irish Parliament to become an independent voice, able to address some of these issues. And so I think that in many ways it was fortunate to have this insight. Now, of course, I look in a much broader way. I look at issues, for example, in relation to the religions of the world and the great gathering of religious leaders that took place at the time of the Millennium Summit. And I am hoping that those religious leaders will address the issues that will be relevant to the World Conference next year in South Africa. It will take place, you know, the end of August, beginning of September of next year. And it's to be like the Beijing Conference on Women, the Rio Conference on the Environment. It's to address all issues of racism, discrimination, intolerance, anti-Semitism, anti-Islamic religion, sources of ethnic cleansing, all of these issues.
Did your parents ever reconcile with your husband?
Oh, within a month or so. I mean, it was a very short-term thing. My husband is... he was a political cartoonist in his time, has a very good sense of humour, a very good sense of balance, and he helped to make sure that it didn't last longer than about a month.
During the period when you were in the Irish Senate and then President of Ireland, and you were working toward... overturning laws against divorce, laws against homosexuality, laws against birth control. Were you still going to church, and was your priest giving you a hard time about your political work?
I have a very strong sense of spirituality, and I was certainly not distanced from the church, and I also was ensuring that my children were in fact given the benefit of being of a family that had strengths of both Catholic and religious and Protestant religion, and therefore they would come to Mass with me, go to church services with me or with my husband, with both of us perhaps, and I think that this was one of the enrichments.
And were you given a hard time in church for your political stance?
I was given a hard time publicly when I first introduced a bill on family planning. I was denounced from the pulpit. It was extremely hard on my parents, particularly on my mother.
And did the climate change?
Yes, I'm glad to say the climate changed very dramatically. And I think it's recognized that I have acted with integrity. I believe in what I'm doing. I believe very strongly in the importance of valuing the rounded contribution of women. And indeed, as president, I particularly recognized the role of women who devote themselves to child-minding, to child-rearing, although I was also encouraging husbands and male partners to play their full role. But I think that I tried to be very inclusive as a woman president, to be a president for all of the people. And I think I drew on the strengths of the fact that I came from a Catholic background, was married to a Protestant husband, was not alienated from a religion that I was, I think, understandably very critical of from time to time. And I would remain critical of it when necessary.
Well, one more thing. Having challenged the Catholic Church in Ireland about things like divorce and birth control, I'm wondering if you feel a little more comfortable than you might otherwise have challenging the customs of other countries now, such as female genital mutilation, countries where they say, oh, this is cultural, so butt out.
I do, yes. I think it helps to be able to discern what is fundamental and what, in fact, is a custom that is actually quite damaging. And those customs may be the hold that at times the Catholic Church has had on Catholic women in rural areas, for example, on their minds and hearts and ways of thinking. Similarly, in African countries, there may be a hold in... Asian countries, there may be a caste system or other ways of discriminating. And I think I can seek to discern what are the fundamental human rights values and try to promote those not in a judgmental, finger-pointing way, but putting emphasis on empowerment, on education from within, on ensuring that women themselves are supported to and educated to be able to make their choices. And when that happens, women do exercise choices that are in the interests of their own human rights and their own self-development.
Mary Robinson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Mary Robinson is the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights and the former president of Ireland. Our interview was recorded yesterday. The countertenor, a male singer with a high vocal range usually associated with women, has become more familiar to today's audiences due to the early music movement. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has been listening to two new recordings by contemporary countertenors. Here's his review.
One of the least understood types of singer by the general public is the countertenor. People often think they're hearing a woman singing, or a man imitating a woman's voice by singing falsetto. But some of the most exciting and dramatic music for countertenors was composed for the castrati of the 18th century, the promising young boys who were castrated in order to keep their boy soprano register. Some of them became superstars. There's nothing necessarily feminine about the repertoire. Handel wrote one of the most masculine roles in opera, Julius Caesar, for just such a heroic high voice. Two of the most admired young singers of the Baroque repertoire today are countertenors. They both have new recordings, and each has something different to offer. The young German countertenor Andreas Scholl is probably still better known in Europe than he is in the U.S. On recordings, you can never be sure how large a voice is. But when I heard him at the Dresden Music Festival, I was impressed not only with the agility, but also with the size of his voice. Most countertenors don't have nearly the vocal thrust and focus that Scholl does. But he's also a singer of unaffected refinement and purity. His new album is a collection of religious music for solo voice by Vivaldi. Here's an aria from the psalm setting, Nisi Dominus. The American countertenor David Daniels has performed beautifully in 18th century opera, especially Handel. But his new album, called Serenade, includes some remarkable departures from the standard countertenor repertory. Daniels mixes songs from the 17th and 18th centuries with Beethoven, Schubert, Gounod, and 20th century art songs by Poulenc and Vaughan Williams. Daniels proves himself quite comfortable in all of these. Here's Schubert's captivating boating song, Auf dem Wasser zu singen. Because women vocalists, from Elizabeth Schumann to Barbara Streisand, have recorded this song, It's odd at first to hear a man singing it, and in what is usually a woman's register. There are awful countertenors whose vocal strain makes you think the high male voice is a freak of nature. I once heard a concert featuring Mozart soprano arias sung by a male soprano in drag. But because both Daniels and Scholl are serious and imaginative artists, they make you stop thinking about peripheral issues like gender to concentrate on the music itself.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed new albums by countertenors Andreas Scholl and David Daniels. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews Almost Famous, Cameron Crowe's new film based on his experiences as a teenaged reporter for Rolling Stone. This is Fresh Air. Almost Famous is the new semi-autobiographical movie about the time in the 70s when screenwriter and director Cameron Crowe was a teenaged writer for Rolling Stone magazine. Crowe wrote the film Fast Times at Ridgemont High and wrote and directed Say Anything and Jerry Maguire. Henry Sheehan has a review.
When a period rock movie opens in 1969 and unwinds mostly during 1973, you know it's going to be full of long hair, bell bottoms, Volkswagens, and all the other details production and costume designers love to pile on. But the moment when you know that the 43-year-old Cameron Crowe has perfectly nailed the era doesn't really need any of that useful stuff. It happens early on when a young woman tells her mom that she's leaving home. The daughter has no hope that her mother will ever understand her reasons, but if she really wants to try to understand her daughter, then mom should listen to a song her splitting offspring is going to play on the family record player. I won't say what the song is, because hearing it is kind of a nostalgic rush and kind of a joke, too. But the encounter does perfectly recall an age when young people, formerly called teenagers, could hear all their frustrations and dreams summed up in a 4-minute rock song, or 15 minutes with guitar and drum solos. And while you might tell your parents you're playing your song for them so they might understand, you didn't really believe that. You played it as a sign of your scorn, for they just didn't have the ears to listen. Moments like this provide a vital and kinetic backdrop for Almost Famous, Crowe's story of his formation as a young writer. Brought up by a strong-willed mother whose convictions ran the gamut from conventional, she was strongly anti-drug, to eccentric, she celebrates Christmas in September to avoid the commercialization, Crowe's character, William Miller, is almost doomed to be exceptional. As a 15-year-old neophyte rock writer, he captures the attention of the legendary rock critic Lester Bangs, ably played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. Bangs warns him against the temptations of going native, of letting rock bands and their record companies seduce him into thinking he is cool. But young William ends up in Temptation's lap in the form of Stillwater, a working band on the eve of a commercial breakthrough. A Rolling Stone editor, not knowing William's tender age, assigns him to go on tour with the group. Along the way, William befriends them, especially their talented lead guitarist, Russell Hammond. Along with Bangs and his mom, Russell becomes one of William's gurus. But gurus can clash, as happens when mom catches up with Williams on a backstage payphone, and Russell, not knowing what he's walking into, tries to condescendingly placate her.
Russell, no, Russell, Russell, Russell.
Hey, Mom, it's Russell Hammond. I play guitar in Stillwater. Hey, how does it feel to be the mother of the greatest rock journalist we've met?
Ow!
Hello? Hello? Look, you got a great kid here. There's nothing to worry about. We're taking good care of him, and you should come to the show sometime.
Hey,
join the circus.
Listen to me, mister. Your charm doesn't work on me. I'm on to you. Oh, of course you like him.
Well, yeah.
He worships you people. And that's fine by you as long as he helps make you rich.
Rich? I don't think so.
Listen to me. He's a smart, good-hearted 15-year-old kid with infinite potential. This is not some apron-wearing mother you're speaking to. I know all about your Valhalla decadence, and I shouldn't have let him go. He's not ready for your world of compromised values and diminished brain cells that you throw away like confetti. Am I speaking to you clearly?
Yes, ma'am.
If you break his spirit, harm him in any way, keep him from his chosen profession, which is law, something you may not value, but I do, you will meet the voice at the other end of this telephone, and it will not be pretty. Do we understand each other?
Yes, ma'am.
I didn't ask for this role, but I'll play it.
That's Frances McDormand as William's mom, and in a movie full of good performances, hers stands out like an eagle among doves. She's just about as predatory, too, until it comes to her young. Then, McDormand the actress is as nurturing as her character. As young William, newcomer Patrick Fugit is intelligent and likable, but he wouldn't come across as quite so complete without his scenes with McDormand. The movie is sprinkled with Crowe's insider looks at rock and roll, but there's a bigger truth to Crowe's emergence as a filmmaker in Almost Famous. One of William's new friends is Penny Lane, a groupie played by Kate Hudson. Almost as young as William, Penny nurses, under a holly-go-lightly exterior, a secret crush on Russell. The guitarist, played by Billy Crudup, uses that crush when he sees fit, but he guards his prerogatives and status as a rock star, too, refusing to take seriously the affections of a woman who may be too good for him. This, in a nutshell, is what Crowe's films are always about. Whether it's Ione Skye not realizing what a treasure John Cusack is in Say Anything, or Tom Cruise overlooking Renee Zellweger in Jerry Maguire, Crowe's films are full of the blindly presumptuous not appreciating the secretly ardent. What's remarkably mature about Crowe is that since he was 15, he's been able to see it all as part of the human comedy.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Helen Wong. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Buffalo Niagara Enterprise, coordinating efforts between local economic development agencies and companies interested in the Buffalo Niagara region. BuffaloNiagara.org. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of the novel The Man Who Ate the 747 by Ben Sherwood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.